Welcome to the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook podcast for the third quarter of 2006. This is episode 3 in our 2006 podcast series. This program was recorded on July 18th, 2006. Hello, I'm Steve Lubetkin, host of these podcasts. I'm managing partner of Lubetkin Communications, LLC, and our subsidiary, Professional Podcasts, LLC. We're a leading producer of professional podcasts for companies and other organizations. The Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook started in 1994 in a modest conference room on the campus of Rutgers School of Business at Camden. It's since grown into a televised business forum that serves as a comprehensive barometer of the health of the South Jersey business community. The Quarterly Business Outlook is produced in cooperation with the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey on the web at www.chambersnj.com. The Quarterly Business Outlook is sponsored by Flaster Greenberg Attorneys at Law, a Cherry Hill-based law firm. Visit www.flastergreenberg.com or phone 856-661-1900. If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, please send an email to steve@lubetkin.net. We'd be pleased to receive audio comments, and we'll use them in a future podcast, so feel free to send an MP3 file. Now, on to today's program. The Quarterly Business Outlook panel for the third quarter of 2006 includes four distinguished local business leaders. Their complete biographies appear in the show notes accompanying this podcast. Speaking on the energy services sector of the economy is Edward Graham, Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer of South Jersey Industries, an energy services holding company. Commenting on trends in the healthcare sector is Dr. Christopher Olivia, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Cooper Health System. That's a leading provider of comprehensive health services, medical education, and clinical research throughout southern New Jersey and the Delaware Valley. In this quarter's program, our representative from the banking sector is William Ryan, Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer of TD Bank North, one of the 25 largest commercial banking organizations in the United States. Departing from the previous custom at the Quarterly Business Outlook of having the economists speak first, this program concludes with a more in-depth presentation about economic trends from David Kotok, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer of Cumberland Advisors, a personal service money management firm with clients in 39 states, the District of Columbia, and several foreign countries. Mr. Kotok's presentation included a series of slides, and we've made these available for you to download and review in the Adobe Acrobat PDF file format. There's a link to the slide deck in the show notes accompanying this podcast. You can find that at rutgersqbopodcast.blogspot.com, and also you can visit the Camden School of Business website at camden-ifn-sbc.rutgers.edu/businesscommunity/outlook.htm. Moderating the Quarterly Business Outlook panel again today is Dr. Mitchell Koza, the Dean and Distinguished Professor of Management at the Rutgers University School of Business in Camden. And now let's go to the lectern as Peter Spergel, Managing Shareholder of Flaster Greenberg, prepares to welcome everyone and introduce today's program.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Peter Spergel. I'm the managing shareholder of Flaster Greenberg. And together with the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey, we're very pleased to once again bring you this installment of the Rutgers Quarterly Business Outlook. I'd like to thank everyone for showing up on such a hot morning. We promise to keep the air condition on. The early results on our panel members here, though, are quite negative, so I'm sure everyone in the room is interested to hear why we have such a negative forecast. In my years of doing this, this is probably the lowest scores I've ever seen. Hopefully, the heat will warm them up today. Anyway, it's my pleasure to be able to introduce to you Deb DiLorenzo. She is the president of the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey. And Deb is going to speak to you about an exciting project that the Chamber undertook this year.
Thank you, Peter, and good morning to everybody. We thought, given the recent actions surrounding the passage of this year's state budget, it was timely to update you on the efforts of the Chamber's Board Council on Responsible Government Spending. At your places, you have our latest report, which details some 34 recommendations on how state government can reduce spending by adopting cost-cutting measures implemented by business. This year, we studied state government employee benefits, state government energy utilization, and state government logistics, distribution logistics and purchasing, and compared these operational areas to those in the private sector. Our goal is to offer best business practices so that state government can reduce the overall cost of its operations and ultimately save all of us, the taxpayers, our hard-earned dollars. We will be working with the governor, with the legislature, and other key players in Trenton about adopting our measures, and we urge you to join us in this process. I thank you for your attention and for your continued support of the Chamber's efforts to change the status quo in Trenton. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Dean Koza, who will begin the program. Dean?
Thank you, Deb. And I want to congratulate Deb on actually sticking to a minute, because getting the president of a chamber to do that is almost as bad as trying to get a professor to do that. We have today an exceptional program, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time chatting with you simply because it's so interesting. I want to turn right to it. And I think that you can see it's such an interesting program that we have probably one of the largest crowds we've had for a July meeting, as I've gone back through the records. So let me, without further ado, turn to our speakers. And the first speaker today is going to be Ed Graham, who is the chairman and president and chief executive officer of South Jersey Industries. And he's going to talk to us today about energy services. Ed?
Thank you. Good morning. What I'd like to do is start off with a very brief history of where we've moved in terms of energy prices to put in context where we sit today and what the outlook looks going forward. If you look back during the 90s, the supply and demand situation was in a much better shape. There was adequate supply in the natural gas industry. In fact, it was a perceived bubble, in fact, an excess of supply. And as we moved into the year 2001, all of that changed, and you saw enormous spikes in terms of price, but also you saw a great deal of volatility in price occur. And likewise, on the oil side, somewhat of a similar story. And as you look through time since 2001, weather varied, and to some degree the price would change, but nonetheless extremely volatile. And now we sit in an environment where prices continue to be at an all-time high since the beginning of 2001. Clearly other factors that are coming into play, as you look at the hurricanes in the Gulf last year and the damage they did to a lot of the natural gas infrastructure, that's having a lasting effect, and a good percentage of that supply has yet to come online. Obviously, as we look to the concerns about the Middle East, the impacts it's having on oil prices, and it's terrible as I listen to the radio coming in, that how favorable at the very end of the day we went below $76 a barrel. So who would have dreamed that 5 or 6 years ago? But obviously the concerns, global concerns, translate into real impacts for us locally. We're seeing all the same effects. And in fact, the movement in oil prices have moved natural gas in the same direction, although not to the same degree. So now as I start to step back and look locally, what's the impact on southern New Jersey and the state and really the region within Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware? You see that we still are affected by the supply is still coming from the same sources. We're either getting a lot of oil from the Middle East or we're getting a lot of our natural gas from the Gulf of Mexico. So we're impacted directly, and for your local utilities, and this is just my one pitch at defensiveness for all our utilities, we don't profit from the supply itself. We're just deliverers of gas. So really, don't hate the local guy delivering the bad news. Look back towards the producers and be more concerned at what's happening globally. But In all seriousness, this is something that's going to carry into the near term. We see still a mismatch in terms of supply and demand. Demand has gone up dramatically over several years. A lot of natural gas fire generation has contributed to the increase in demand. Likewise, the not my backyard limitations on drilling, also new supplies are not coming on as rapidly as we need as we see existing wells diminish. So it doesn't paint a great picture in terms of where is pricing going in the next few years. However, there are some actions that we can take as companies and we can take as consumers that affects that. One side of the equation is clearly to influence the demand side, how much you consume. And the other side is starting to take advantage of alternate technologies, things that can provide energy without impacting or making us more reliable on some of the fossil fuels. At South Jersey Industries, we've made, a historic change in our view. We're no longer looking to have our customers consume more energy. Our approach is really efficiency, and we filed with our regulators to actually change the mechanism as to how we earn our profits. So going into next winter, we would anticipate that we're earning profits by how many households we serve, irregardless of their consumption. So far, it seems like, well, that's quite a win for the utility. Their profits are preserved, and that's true. But also, we become the biggest advocate of conservation and installing high-efficiency equipment and exploring alternate technologies as sources of fuel. I think you'll see going forward more and more utilities around the country will take that approach. That can contribute. It'll take a long time, so that's a partial solution. The other side of the equation, just to touch on one more project, I've got my one-minute warning, is the LNG facility that BP proposes to build in southern New Jersey, a terminal that would bring in LNG to our region. Very significant project, something that truly will stabilize price and I would think actually drive price down. So it would bring in 1.2 billion cubic feet a day of supplies into the region, an enormous plus. So something you should become familiar with and supportive of. So with that, I'll wrap it up and turn it back to the doctor.
Thank you, Ed. Can you share your ratings with us?
My ratings, I guess, were 60 and stable.
Thank you. It is remarkable, isn't it, the degree to which we see the same message that was emerging in our last meeting, and that is the fundamental embeddedness of the regional, the local economy in the global world. Now, certainly in energy, it's clear and present, and yet I think we'll find that it is something that is a much more general trend, something that will accelerate in the future. Why don't we turn now to the second sector that we're going to be looking at today, which is healthcare, and I'm delighted to have Dr. Christopher Olivier here with us, who is the President and Chief Operating Officer at Cooper, and I think is well known to many of us here. So let me turn it over to Chris, please.
Thank you, Mitchell. Well, I've been asked why I'm the pessimist, although I'm not necessarily pessimistic by nature in a group. That's because I sit on my left next to an energy executive and on my right a banking executive, two of my biggest suppliers who are both optimists. I want to speak...
Got to come from somewhere.
That's right. I want to speak a little bit about the good news in our industry, which is that you will only be experiencing high single and low double-digit premium increases over the next year. Now to the other news. I think healthcare has been in the national news, and I'll drop it down to the local setting recently because of the troubles at GM. And Rick Wagoner has blamed the troubles in selling cars on a whole host of issues, not the least of which is healthcare. Unfortunately, what he fails to mention is that Toyota, Nissan, BMW all build cars in this country. And in fact, they have to pay healthcare costs for their workers also. And what the real problem at GM is the legacy issues of healthcare costs for the retirees and management decisions that were made in the past and not necessarily healthcare. So what GM has to do is build cars that people want to drive. But that doesn't mean that healthcare is not an issue on a broader context. We see a number of things on the horizon that are driving the price inflation that you're experiencing on a national basis. The increase in technology costs is a major factor in this industry. Our labor force, which is highly educated, is scarce. We do not have enough nurses, doctors, specialists to take care of all of us in this room. And that is another reason why you don't get the same economies as you do in the technology industry, because it is truly a professional service business. And also, there's a lot of unfunded mandates on healthcare providers. And I'll speak a little bit more about that, but it's broadly the burden of the underinsured and uninsured, which is borne by us and then ultimately by all of you. And then finally, on a broad context, Medicare Part D that the Bush administration pushed and passed through Congress is taking up very scarce resources on the federal level, which are being consumed in other aspects of the economy, and that's going to put further pressure on Medicare pricing to doctors and hospitals that will cause additional cost shifting on a local level. In New Jersey, behind property taxes, health care is the number one issue, and you'll be hearing more about it if the property tax convention gets off in the fall and the reallocation of the state sales tax increase. New Jersey is unique in many ways. New Jersey has high median income, but also a very broad standard deviation. So you have a lot of poor and a lot of rich in this state. And because of that, you have roughly 8.5 million people, but 1.3 to 1.4 million of them are uninsured. Contrast that with Massachusetts, which recently passed, quote, comprehensive health care reform. They have around 600,000, 650,000, so well over double the amount. The trouble with the industry here locally that's causing your premiums to be high, and affordability, I believe, is really the number one issue, are poor state payments for the underinsured and uninsured to providers in the form of Medicaid and charity care. This leads to massive cost shifting, which causes private industry, businesses, and individuals. Remember, there's only three sources of funding for healthcare: government, business, and individuals, to pay 150 to 170% of cost for the same product. Why is that? That is, as I said, systematic underpayments from the state government, first and foremost in New Jersey, and secondarily from Medicare, the federal government. In the state of New Jersey, Medicare pays 90% of cost. Charity care and Medicaid, the state programs, pay well below that, maybe on average 40 to 50% of cost. All that is cost shifted back to you, and that's why rates are so high. Now, what do I see on the horizon for reform? And this, Cooper, we've been blessed the last 4 years with our four most successful years in history. This year is going to be another record year for us. However, I will say half the hospitals, provider organizations in the state are losing money. Moody's has the state rated negative, negative, negative for the foreseeable future. And that's why I think the broad outlook is pessimistic here. No. That there are a couple of reform issues. Can you still hear me out there? On the horizon, Massachusetts is the only state-level reform. Let me just talk about three very briefly. The Bush administration's pushing consumer-driven health care. The utilizer as purchaser, that's HSA and MSA accounts that you've heard quite a bit about. Many large businesses are shifting to them, shifting the risk for the first dollar over to the employee. Quality data reporting, that's the second initiative. In order to be an informed purchaser, you have to know what product's a good product and what product's not a good product. And I am involved personally with this at the federal level. You'll see more quality reporting, data reporting of hospitals and physicians. And finally, another key component to have a competitive market is transparency in pricing. And that will be the third leg. You'll be hearing more about hospitals, doctors publishing, making public, and hopefully competing on pricing in an attempt to drive a consumer-driven market. That is the only major reform that's on the horizon regarding the affordability of health care at the federal level, frankly, in New Jersey at this point also, and it remains to be seen what impact that's going to have.
Great. Thank you, Chris. And your rating, please.
Oh, my rating is, my industry rating, my rating on Cooper is bullish, but I didn't put it
in. Rating on Cooper is bullish. Okay.
But my industry rating is a 25. Again, over half the hospitals are losing money in the state, and we're at the peak of the pricing for the industry, so these should be good times. They are for many hospitals nationwide, and I think the outlook likewise is going to be weak or worse for the sector.
Thank you, Chris. It reminds me a little bit of the mayor of, not you, but the exercise. It reminds me of the mayor of New York one time. You may remember Mayor Lindsay, who many years ago was shocked to find out that half the kids in New York read below average. Well, the message that we're getting is actually remarkable. If you compare energy and healthcare, two remarkably different sectors, what we're finding is you know, the world is more complex than it's ever been. Now, that statement certainly has been always true. 4,000 years ago, the world was more complex than it's ever been. But I think what we're seeing today is an acceleration in the pace of change in the environment and, to some degree, the direction of change. And so the fundamental interest that we have is trying to understand how is it that companies are going to be able to adapt as these environments become increasingly unpredictable. And it's opportune that we turn now to the banking sector, where there has been a remarkable amount of restructuring, adaptation, as it were. And let me introduce to you Bill Ryan, who's the chairman, president, and chief executive officer of TD Bank North. Bill?
Mitchell, good morning, and thank you very much for having me here today. Banking has certainly been an interesting industry that many of us remember for a number of years as a fairly boring industry that's all of a sudden in a consolidation mode. Before I discuss it, though, you may not know TD Bank North. We're a $40 billion banking company, the 25th largest in the United States, headquartered in Portland, Maine. And we've developed a retail model over the last few years and commercial model that has worked fairly well. So we've been bringing it through the New England states, and now recently purchased Hudson United Bank and Interchange Bank in New Jersey. So we're continuing that model coming down the Northeast. Model works fairly well. Forbes magazine picked us as the best managed bank in America in 2004, and we were the runner-up for best managed bank in America in 2005. So we're feeling very comfortable with what we're doing. Banking, though, is consolidating. The cost of regulation, the cost of computerization, the cost of marketing is really driving the smaller banks into a mode where they have to look for a larger partner, somebody to share those costs with. There are 9,000 banks, roughly, in America. In all of Canada, there are 19. In most European countries, there are 10 or 12. So we've got this America dilemma of a bank on every corner that really can't afford to run itself over the next few years, as well as it's run itself over the last four. 15 years ago, there were 18,000 banks in America, and the experts said there'd be 9 today. So those experts were right. And the same experts are predicting in 5 years that there'll be about 4,500 banks in America as we go forth. And there's probably a lot of truth to that. So you'll continue to read about banks consolidating, being purchased or sold to different banking companies, and that mode should continue certainly for the next several years. As a customer of a bank, if you're lending money, you feel okay, but not as good as the people putting money in the bank. As you know, the Fed has been fighting inflation that none of us have seen, really, it may be up to now, for the last several years. So there have been 18 rate increases over the last several years. So if you're lending money, you're lending it a little bit more expensive today than you were a few years ago. But if you're putting money in a bank, all of a sudden, certificates of deposit, CD rates, you're in that mode of 4 to 5%, or if not higher. So it's a dilemma for customers. They love putting the money in the bank at high rates, but they hate to borrow the money at just as high rates. Particularly in the mortgage industry, as we're seeing right now, it's been a great era for the last few years about people getting into their homes at very low rates. That has changed over the last years and will continue to change over the next few. May create a problem as we go forth, as all of a sudden people's mortgage payments could be almost doubled if you've got a variable rate loan that you've purchased a few years ago as rates adjust up in the next few years. In general, though, the banking environment, as you see by my rating, is really pretty good. We come off the economy. The economy's growing at 3.5% a year. That's a very good growth rate, and it's diminished to some degree by what you read in the newspapers, but when you cut through that, it's really a very good economy. America, if you think about it, was the economy that was fat and overworked and couldn't go anywhere in the 21st century. The productivity in America compared to the rest of the world is unmatched, and our ability to be very productive have allowed our economies to grow quite a bit more than almost any other economy in the world. So even though there are issues, these issues are pale in comparison to the rest of the world and what they're going through. Rest of the world is dragging us down a little bit economically, but we're certainly going to get through that. The key event I look for, the key barometer that I focus on, is the unemployment rate. If both spouses are working,
the payments will get made on whatever debt they have. If unemployment moves up and one spouse gets laid off, or maybe both, then we have real issues. The unemployment rate right now is between 4 and 5%, and anybody who's followed it will tell you it's as good as it gets. Individually, people may not feel good because maybe they're in that 4 to 5% mode, but when you look at it overall, it's a great economy right now, 3.5% GNP growth, and a 4 to 5% unemployment rate. Statistically, if unemployment gets back over 6%, we will have real issues. Consumers will stop buying products and spending monies, and the economy will really struggle to a great degree. Nobody who's followed this sees that happening in the next year or two. They all have a sense that this is a good economy and it's growing very nicely. Recent tidbits have come out. You know, the revenue payments in the IRS, if you noticed in the last month, are at record levels. So it seems like things are going very well. At the same time that things are going well, we have some instability in the world that scares us all. What's going on overseas in Israel and Lebanon and Afghanistan and Iraq can certainly have a major be a major factor in the economy going sideways if that continues to be the case. We always have this sense that the world will find a way to solve its problems. It has in the past. Certainly we're praying that they find a way to solve it in the future. But on a temporary basis, it does create real issues. Oil prices have never been higher. I was coming down from Portland, and I'm not so sure I'm going to say fill her up again for a while. I may want to say give me $40 worth instead of fill her up. So oil prices are certainly a potential factor that will tone down the spending that all of us do. Doesn't seem to be the case right now. They've been paying higher prices in Europe for years, so there's a sense we'll get through that. Higher mortgage payments will be a factor potentially in how people view the world as they go forth. So that's a factor to look at from the that same standpoint. So we'll see. There's a sense we'll get through these issues, but they are real issues. And certainly if we have another terrorist event in America, all bets are off as we go forth. So things look good right now from the banking standpoint. They're moving nicely. Follow the unemployment rates. If unemployment starts to really edge up close to 6%, then you may want to hunker down a little bit. If unemployment stays in that 4 to 5.5% range, I think things will move very nicely. Philadelphia, the greater Philadelphia, southern New Jersey area, will do very well. I'll give you one statistic and I'll end. The average home price in this area is $186,000. The average home price in northern New Jersey is $395,000. People will commute longer because they want to live in an area they can afford. So this area will probably go through a very good period of people adjusting from northern New Jersey, coming down, commuting longer, if gas prices aren't too high, and living in this area. So there's a good positive outlook for this region over the next few years. Mitchell, thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Can you just give us your ratings, please?
Yeah, my rating is I'm the optimist in the group at 75 and stable, and it's really based on the economy and unemployment staying at very nice levels.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. And again, the message, again, is the embeddedness of our own local economy in the global economy. And in developing this theme, we're going to depart a little bit from our traditional way of operating. And instead of keeping to the seven-minute timeline, I've invented, not that I want to take credit for this, but I've invited David Kotuk to join us. And David is the chief economist and head of operations, really, over at Cumberland Advisors. He's also the program chair and, I believe, president of the Global Interdependence Center. And David is going to share with us his own views of the global economy.
Thank you very much, Mitchell. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's particularly a pleasure to see my old friends Peter Gold from Rutgers and Frank Riesenberger from the Flaster Greenberg firm. So it's very nice, and thank you for inviting me. Being the sixth speaker at a time-sensitive breakfast meeting reminds me of perhaps being Elizabeth Taylor's sixth husband. But I'll do my best. What I'd like to do in an economy of time is discuss how things have changed in the world in the last 8 years, where that reflected globally in economics and financial markets, how that impacted most of the people in this room in terms of stocks and bonds, bring it fast forward to what happened in the stock market in the last 2 months, and then render a forecast, cover the entire globe, and do it in 20 minutes. We're going to start, and everyone in front of you should have a chart pack with all of these slides. I will not be spending a lot of time on the slides. I'm going to go through them very quickly, and there's an appendix in the back which has all the numbers in case you're interested in the details. So let's get fast forward. First of all, the world has experienced a lot of shocks in terms of terrorism. You can see by the slide I've listed a few. And it's also encountered financial shocks. They're listed there, too. What the world did, world organizations led by the Federal Reserve and the G7 countries, now it's a G8, I wonder why Russia's in there, but they're in there now, but led by the G7 and the Federal Reserve, is start to have a dialogue to reduce risk because of the shocks you've seen and many more which didn't make the slide. And something that we may not get a lot of attention to in the local area, the Financial Stability Forum, was created. The guy who was behind that, the moving force, was Alan Greenspan. And Roger Ferguson, who just retired from the Federal Reserve as its vice chairman, was the head of the Financial Stability Forum. It started in the G7. It now incorporates nearly every country, every central bank, every financial institution in the world. And what that organization does is cooperate to avoid shocks and risks. We know they're successful because of what we don't see. We did not see the worldwide payment system collapse after 9/11. What you didn't see is what's important. If a stability forum works, you don't see a crisis. And so the preparation for Y2K, nothing happened. 9/11, nobody defaulted. Not one payroll was missed. So the stability forum is very active in its working to reduce risk. What that did is change the risk profile of the entire world. Here's a look at risk profiles. We measure risk profiles a number of ways. Here we're going to measure them in the bond market. And that's what happened with risk premiums, the gap between a high-risk piece of paper that pays interest and a low-risk piece of paper that pays interest outside of the United States. I've marked long-term capital's collapse in 1998, 9/11, and Argentina's default. That was the largest sovereign debt default in history. On this, but you can see what has happened to risk premiums. They have declined for years. The same thing has happened inside the United States. And you can see it in another form inside the United States. And there's a fear index calculated by Ned Davis Research, which you see at the bottom of the slide. Essentially, we've reached a point in which we are not afraid of risk. We have lowered our fear of risk. And part of the reason is this global trend, which has been underway and was accelerated starting with the 1998 collapse of long-term capital, a hedge fund. Now, risk premiums in bond markets are easy to measure. You look at a spread between A and B. In the stock market, we have to estimate them. But look at what happened in the stock market. And look at what happened in the global economy. We're going to combine the two right here. This is what the world looked like three ways in 1998. Let me explain the columns very quickly. On your right side, you see the largest stock markets in the world, and they're ordered by their total value. Add up all the stocks, multiply it by the market price, you got a number. That's what all the stocks are worth in that particular country. In the middle, you see the world ordered by U.S. dollar accounting. A GDP measure is a U.S. dollar-centric way of accounting for all of the output of the world. And on the left side, you see purchasing power parity. That is a World Bank estimate of measuring the output of the world by units of output, by goods, not by dollars. Let me explain the difference very quickly. In the United States, someone has an entry-level job, gets paid $20,000 a year, takes $2, goes to the local convenience store and buys a dozen eggs. In China, the same person has a similar job, makes a knockoff version of the same widget, gets paid in U.S. dollar terms what would be $2,000 a year. They're paid in local currency. They go to the local farmer's market. They buy a dozen eggs. When you convert the currency, the eggs cost 20 cents a dozen. $20,000, $2, $2,000, 20 cents. In GDP accounting, one of those is 10 times the size of the other. In PPP accounting, they are equal. Now, not everything in the world trades. Chickens and eggs don't. You want eggs, you go to your local chicken. This country imports no eggs from China, and we import no chickens from China, but there may be an avian flu reason as well. The fact is, GDP accounting is not right or wrong. It's a method of tallying up the quantity of things. PPP accounting is not right or wrong. It's another method of tallying up things. Okay, picture in 1998. This is what it looked like after long-term capital. Notice that the United States had 50% of the total market capitalization of the world in its financial market if we measure it by stocks. That's what the world looked like in 2005. Obviously, the U.S. lost a little share, but look at China, a big number two, and India, about the size of Japan, if you look at the left side. And if you want to understand the movement in commodity prices and movement of goods around the world, you look at China and look at India, and you can see how large they are when we measure them by PPP, units of outputs of goods. You can also see what happened to the markets. Obviously, the world got bigger by both GDP accounting and PPP accounting, and the stock markets reflected it, and they got worth more. They went up in price. If we look at the world measured by PPP, it's 50% larger than it was 8 years ago in units of output in stuff. By GDP, about the same. The distribution is there. And look what happened to the stock markets. Now, all stock markets in the world, virtually all, went up. That means the equity value of every business went up if you merged them all together. Some went up more than others. And it's the differential, or the share, that counts. In the first quarter of 2006, we had a big upward movement in the worldwide stock markets. The stock markets of the world gained value of about 10% in 90 days. This is what happened to the U.S. share. Now, that doesn't mean our markets didn't go up. Let me rephrase. Our markets went up too. Their markets went up more. Why? Flows of funds were moving in the world, and in a globally linked economy, which we've just seen is the case, it's global flows of funds which drive all or most of the financial markets and the economics of all the economies. This is what happened to the share of stock market wealth. And we're going to go really quick through these slides because of the limitation of time, but you get to see China. You get to see India came from nowhere. You get to see what the values are in various places in the world. Look what happened to the original 11 monetary union, European monetary union countries. They lost share. Those are the old guys, the ones who have sclerosis in Europe. That's France, Italy. They lost share. Their markets went up, but as a share of the whole pie, their value is now less than it was in 1998 as a proportion. And we'll run through markets very quickly. I don't want to spend a lot of time on these slides. Okay, we're going to skip to chart 32 in the interest of time. From 1998... till the first quarter of 2006, we watched our market share drop from 50% of the world total value in equities to 40. We watched this flow of funds. We saw the contraction of risk premiums, and that explains why. Because if risk premiums contract, higher risk areas of the world grow. We continue to see money leaving foreign markets right through today. Now, risk premiums are still very, very low. That is a cause for long-term optimism. And the Financial Stability Forum, the cooperation between financial institutions, is still very much intact and active. Risk premiums are higher now than they were 2 or 3 months ago because of events we know about in the world and because of one other single thing which I'm going to show you which might explain why the stock market in early May tumbled worldwide. We need to be alert about shocks. Now, we know all the shocks that are on this list, so we don't have to spend any time on them now. A natural disaster can be a hurricane or a tsunami. Protectionism doesn't get enough attention. That's the Schumer bill, which would impose a 27.5% tariff on all Chinese imports if it ever got traction in the Senate. It is a big shock if it occurs. No one believes it will occur. By the way, in politics, when no one believes something, we should really be looking out for it. The rest of the list you know. I'm going to get to one which doesn't get a lot of attention, and that's financial market regime change. That means a structure in the world which is altered, an inflection point. And we saw it, and we saw it start on May the 9th. What I'm talking about here is the Japanese decision to move their interest rate off of the zero interest rate policy. For years, Japan has maintained a zero interest rate, and it has essentially created huge amounts of excess liquidity which flowed worldwide at the same time those risk premiums were declining. And that was the fuel for business expansion, lower interest rates, worldwide globalization. In March, the Japanese said, we're going to stop this. Markets paid no attention. In May, they stopped it. Look at the changes in market values from March 31st to May 9th. And in June 12th, the Japanese called a halt to the withdrawal of liquidity. And so we've identified those key dates, and we've also identified the London interbank interest rate denominated in Japanese yen. Now, a banker like Bill would understand and use LIBOR in his business because he's linked to dollar lending. But my suspicion is, Bill, and I may be wrong, but I don't think you do much yen borrowing off of LIBOR. But the world does. And so what happened is the Japanese on March 9th said, we're going to change policy. Markets went merrily along the way. On May 8th, they did it, upstarted an interest rate from a very low level, and a shock hit the world. And you can see when they adjusted on June 12th, because they made a reserve change and stopped withdrawing liquidity. Look at what happened to financial markets and stock markets. Australia, Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, the S&P 500, we know that one. The big stocks in Europe. Everything that happens in the financial markets, stocks, bonds, everything in this world, nearly everything, is linked. Nearly everything is linked. In the general sense, there are no exceptions. Now, the key for a businessman or an investor is to try to figure out those links. That's what we do in our shop. We're a money management firm. All the time, we spend half our day, every day, trying to figure out links before somebody else. You've had, right here in this forum, two good indicators of links. Ed Graham runs a natural gas supply company, and he and I discussed the fact that he's protecting himself and his company and his customers against natural gas price increases in an environment in which energy is very threatened, and we know what's going on with the oil price, because he hedges and he prepares himself for that business. Bill runs a bank and matches his maturity so he doesn't get out of balance because he knows he's dealing with a climate. What you do in the healthcare industry when your future is half decided by others, you just heard. I belong to a group that lobbies in Washington to protect my industry because that's the business that we see in front of us. Okay. I'm supposed to forecast. And Peter Gold said to me, now you must end on an upbeat note. So, Peter, I'm going to revoke my seating in the no smiling section on the airplane. But I have to say it like we see it. The Federal Reserve has a meeting coming up on August 8th. The futures market is pricing a slight probability they will increase rates to 5.25%. A lot of that will depend on the information between now and then. There's a very good chance the Fed may pause. We will learn a lot about what the Fed is going to do, and the financial markets will react when Ben Bernanke starts to talk tomorrow. All eyes are on that. And clues may come out of that speech. I would expect whatever the futures market prices the federal funds rate after his 2 days of testimony is probably going to be the outcome. The federal funds futures market, that's the market which discusses the price of interbank reserve lending, has a 100% accuracy when it's within 30 days of a Federal Reserve meeting. Before that, it's quite volatile. But when you get very close to the meeting, Fed funds futures is very, very accurate. It's never failed. And so I would say, you want to know what the Fed's going to do on August 8th? Look at the price in the futures market 3 days from now after Bernanke has gone through 2 days of testimony. The Federal Reserve is not easing rates. So if interest rates are either rising or maybe stopping to rise for a while, pause is not a decline, then you're in an environment in which this long 7-year trend of declining risk premiums is over. You must now think of the fact that we've had 25 years of declining interest rates, 25 years of declining inflation. We bottomed in 2003, and we've made some sort of plateau, and we're starting to trend higher. How much higher? When in the future? What will it mean? None of us know. Interest rates. That's a risk. Housing. I want to follow up a comment that Bill said about housing. Housing is now serious. $1 trillion of mortgages are resetting their interest rates in the next 12 months, another trillion after that. And so we're looking at real pressure on housing and real pressure on about 10 million households, 30 million people, one-tenth of the population of the United States, who are going to have a rising mortgage payment impact their household. At the same time, their energy bill is up above 6% of their income. That's a threshold where it's previously slowed things down. And their payments for necessities is up from 51% of their income to 55% of their income. And that's a place which slowed things down. So we have pressure from energy. We think the economy will slow to a growth rate below its natural trend. It'll be there for a while because this adjustment process has to take place. We think the summer into the fall is going to be rocky in terms of events. You see them on television every day. Rocky in terms of volatility. And we would say three things. There are lots of potential shocks. Watch for contagion, the linkage of one thing to another, and keep an eye on Japan. Japan is still the source of the cheapest liquidity in the world. In the long run, there are institutions which now work to prevent shocks. There's not going to be a Great Depression. We're not going to have a massive systemic shock. The world is still a good place to do business, invest, and as Peter Gold said to me this morning, in the end, we should be optimists. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to hear the optimistic statement, because now I'm going to ask you for your rating, please.
This is the first experience I have with ratings. I think the economy gets worse before it gets better for the reasons I just discussed.
Okay. Very good. Well, we have a few more minutes, and we always like to leave this open for questions, for comments, and quibbles. And let's turn it over to you.
What is the secret with Cooper versus all the other hospitals having financial problems and labor problems and so forth, and you're doing so well? What is your big secret?
Management? I think we have been fortunate in the last couple of years because we've had an opportunity to position the medical center as South Jersey's University Hospital and to really move into that space that was really unoccupied in the past by any other health system. We've been an academic center for 20-plus years, but really did not promote it as such. Marketplace did not recognize it, and we didn't even understand it ourselves about 5-6 years ago. We've been able to recruit and retain some of the better doctors and nurses in the marketplace, and that's allowed us to stem the tide of business that goes across the river. That business totals nearly $1 billion a year in direct healthcare economic activity. And so that's been our target, and we've made inroads into the outmigration of patients heading to Philadelphia for their medical care by, frankly, building equivalent or better care on this side of the river. So I think that's what's allowed us to buck the trend in the industry. The industry pretty much has been the same last 4 years or so. Half the hospitals are losing money. Many physician practices are struggling in this state, particularly in the primary care disciplines, and we are under-resourced in a number of different areas. Many hospitals do not have certain specialty coverages, and particularly in South Jersey, particularly in the more rural areas. So we've been able to buck the trend really by defining ourselves in the marketplace, attracting the best doctors and nurses, and stemming the tide of business flowing across the bridges into Philadelphia.
Another one, please.
My question's for David. David, you have 2 days, May 9th and June 13, as key dates where you're tracking what you view to be the impact of the decision in Japan to raise rates by 25 basis points, or to have an interest rate. During that same time period, the Fed raised its rates by 25 basis points. A lot of other things happened. I'm just not so clear on why it is that you look at this one event in Japan as being this overriding event, that somehow it impacted worldwide liquidity to such an extent that it had more impact than other, perhaps, other events that may have had similar impact as well.
The question was why we look at this one event in Japan. We actually, Frank, look at all of the things you mentioned, the Fed raising interest rates, concern about inflation, all the developments. So there's no single indicator that brings you to a decision. The interesting thing is the same things that we would look at on May the 10th, we would look at on May the 7th and May the 6th. They were still at work. What was new and introduced on May 9th was an adjustment of a price in the financial markets, and that price had been the same for some time. What Japan had done to maintain a zero interest rate on its policy rate is create huge amount of excess yen above and beyond all of the needs their economy had. And all the rest of the world that was able to figure it out found a way to borrow it. Now, you know and I know, if you can borrow at zero and invest in something or lend in something at five, and the lender at zero says to you, I'm going to stay at zero for a while, you've got yourself a pretty good deal. And so in the beginning, it started small, and it grew and grew and grew. The amount of, if you include derivatives, of what's called the carry trade, which is the term for borrowing at a very low interest rate and investing in something else, is in the trillions worldwide. Suddenly, Japan changed the game. They withdrew this excess liquidity that they had to create to keep that interest rate at zero. Now, they've just raised their interest rate to 0.25%. Our policy rate is 5.25%. However, they are now dealing with conventional reserves. The excess is being withdrawn. Most of it is withdrawn. And on June the 12th in Japan, they realized they may have gone too far. So they pumped up the reserves. That's why I picked the 2 dates. It's one of many things to look at. It happens to be the biggest single unusual change in the financial regime in the last few years, and that's why I picked it to put it in the slides.
Good. There was another one. Yes.
David, a quick question for you. What's your short-term and then long-term outlook on TIPS?
The question is short-term, long-term outlook on TIPS. TIPS are the inflation-adjusted treasuries that are issued by the United States. And currently, TIPS are yielding somewhere around 2.6, I think today about 2.5, 2.6, plus the change in the consumer price index. And the consumer price index is the headline consumer price index, so it's the one that includes energy and food. History in the United States, tips have only traded since 1997. So they started new. They paid about a 4% real interest rate. They went all the way down to below a 2% real interest rate. And for the last few years, they've been in a range of about 2.25 to 2.75. It would appear that they are still pricing a real interest rate too low, and that a more average, longer-term view of TIPS is that they should trade somewhere around a 3% in the real interest rate. That would be 3 plus the forecast of the Consumer Price Index. So our outlook is TIPS are still not a bargain. It's too soon to buy them. They are a lot better or more desirable than they were when the interest rate was a lot lower, but too soon to get into that part. I hope that helped.
Good. Thank you very much. We have time for one more. Let's take one on this side of the room, if we may.
I thought maybe if you can help me understand the strong dollar, weak dollar policy, and, you know, if that helps us or hurts us or...
The question is having to do with a strong dollar, weak dollar. The first thing is, if the Treasury Secretary of the United States says we should have a strong dollar, ignore him. No Treasury Secretary will ever say anything else. If one did a long time ago, his name was Baker, and he sent the currency markets into a tiz. The value of our currency is under pressure because we owe the rest of the world about $15 trillion. The rest of the world owes us about $12 trillion. The return on the investment is higher for us when we place investments abroad than the return they get on the investments here. Why? Because a great deal of the investments here are in government bonds and treasuries and things like that, and a great deal of our investments abroad are in subsidiary companies of American corporations. That gap is widening, so it's a $3 trillion gap. It's probably closer to $3.25 trillion today. And the returns are adjusting. And so for the first time this year, the total of the returns went negative on the United States. That's the first time in many, many, many years. And this is a compounding problem. What that says is that over time, the U.S. is a place that has to reprice. The price of the dollar has to change, and that's where the adjustment process worldwide takes place. We've been living with it for a while. We had a temporary halt for a year because of a change in a tax law that brought a few hundred billion back from foreign subsidiaries. That's over. It ended last year. And so we again see this notion of a weakening dollar. When you have a crisis in the world, America is the single best place to be, and we just saw it in the last few weeks when you saw a flight to the dollar. Our interest rates in the Treasury market dropped because worldwide people looked around the globe, said, you know what, it's a dangerous place. I want to get my money back in the U.S. So the flight to quality, anchor place of the United States, is still very valid worldwide. But the returns on investment, all things equal, is working against the United States and in favor of other places. So if we don't have crisis, war, the likelihood is our dollar gets weaker for that differential.
Good. Well, I think that brings us to a close. I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors at Flassner Greenberg and at the South Jersey Chamber for their continued and vigorous support of this important event. I want to thank all of our panelists for sharing with us their views, not only of their own particular environments, competitive and technological environments, but also for their views of the ways in which their industries are being influenced by trends that are outside of their own control. I have a very good friend that likes to say she spends her life agonizing over personal decisions only to find that she's a member of a trend. So I thank you very much. Have a good, safe trip home or back to work, and stay cool.
That will conclude this edition of the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook podcast. We hope you enjoyed the program. For more information on upcoming programs from Rutgers University School of Business at Camden, please visit the Rutgers website at camden-sbc.rutgers.edu. lubetkin.edu. For more information on Lubetkin Communications, our public relations and podcasting services, please visit our website, www.lubetkin.net. Again, if you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, please email us at steve@lubetkin.net. And if you send us an audio comment, we'll consider using it in a future program. Special thanks to Samantha Collier and Michael Sapanik of Rutgers University for their assistance in the production of these programs. And we do produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts, LLC, in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey, and Flaster Greenberg, our presenting sponsor, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.